Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 metre peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 6th of May, these are our main stories. Palestinians are beginning to move out of Rafah in Gaza after an Israeli order to leave. One woman told us what this means for her.
I have no place to go. This was the last place I know. And actually, if I want to come back to Khan Yunis, there is no place. It's all destroyed.
China's President Xi Jinping is in France on the first stop of a tour of Europe. The people of Chad are voting for a new president after 3 years of military rule, but there's scepticism about how much change it will bring. Also this podcast, combat veterans in Ukraine say the method of conscription should change.
It would be more effective if a military recruitment office would say you will have super hard job, infantry, but, for example, for half a year.
And correcting a music myth about Mama Cass Elliot. Many countries, including the United States, have warned against Israel's planned ground offensive into Rafah, a city in the southern Gaza Strip, now home to about 1.5 million people sheltering from the conflict. But now 100,000 Gazans have been ordered to leave eastern Rafah to what have been called humanitarian zones. The Israeli military says the military operation there will be of limited scope. A Hamas official has described the move as a dangerous escalation. Ghada Al-Khurd is a mother of two who's already been displaced 6 times since the start of the conflict. She lives near the affected areas in Rafah and has been speaking to the BBC's Michel Hussein.
I'm so confused, just to be honest. I have no place to go. This was the last place I know. And actually, if I want to come back to Khan Yunis, there is no place. It's all destroyed. To areas of Al-Mawasi, they are crowded and I cannot anymore live inside tent. It's so hot and my health, it's not allowed for me to be in such situation.
When you say you're hearing about an evacuation plan, how are people hearing?
The flyers, the Israeli Defense Forces, they threw flyers to all of these areas, and actually to my place now, I saw one of these flyers nearby, and they are start to call people records to evacuate these areas and send messages to people to evacuate. And already they announced on the X that you should evacuate these areas, and people are like trying to call each other just to be in a safer place.
And do these flyers or these messages, do they say where you should evacuate to?
Yeah, they said like you have to evacuate the humanitarian, the expanded humanitarian areas in Al-Mawasi and Khan Yunis.
And do you think that if you went there, you would be safe there?
I don't think so. No, absolutely not. Khan Yunis is completely destroyed and they conducted some ground invasion. Deir el-Balah, I mean the middle area, it's all being targeted. I've been there and I saw like huge destructions in areas. Camps of Maghazi, Al-Burayj and Al-Nusayrat, also they are near the border of Gaza, so it's still very dangerous.
Must be really difficult to know what to do. You've been, you know, you've told us that you're confused. What are you with a group of people? I think before when we spoke, you were with your sister. Are you still together? So you will decide together what to do.
Fortunately, my sisters, all of them, they went out from Gaza. They are now in Egypt. I'm still here with my brothers. So if we will move, we will move together. But where to go, we don't know yet.
Gil Dickman's aunt was killed on October the 7th and two of his cousins were taken hostage. One has been released. He told the BBC he's feeling very weary about what's happening.
Now, unfortunately, We're very much afraid as families of hostages about what's going to happen. We're very much afraid that the IDF entering Rafah will risk the lives not only of innocent people, not only of soldiers, but also of some hostages who might be risked because of the attack on Rafah.
So, what do we know about this latest evacuation? I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
We started to see some of the displaced Palestinians on the move again. Pictures that we've seen many times during the past 7 months of the conflict. As we were hearing there, many of those who are moving with what's left of their belongings in black plastic bags. This is maybe their fifth, sixth, seventh time that they've had to move, moving with donkey carts, with a car if they still have one, on foot. It's a miserable scene. I mean, it's raining hard there, so it gives a sense of the misery. And as we were hearing there, where they've been told to go by the Israeli army, they don't see as any better in terms of what it can provide than where they are at the moment. These are two camp cities, which are already, according to Gazans, very overcrowded. And they just simply don't believe the assurances that Israel gives them, the military gives them, that they'll be safe there, because each time they've moved to a place they've been told that safe, it hasn't turned out to be so.
So what does this tell us, do you think, Sebastian, about the state of the peace process? Because there had been talks going on in Cairo.
There had been. And as we've seen before, they started off very positively. Big signs from all sides, mediators from Hamas, from Israel. Talk of a compromise between the two sides. The US selling it very strongly is saying this is a really generous deal that Israel is making. And what we've seen in the last couple of days in Cairo, where the talks were happening, and now they moved to Qatar, where the Hamas delegation went after the talks, is both sides essentially accusing each other of causing them essentially to collapse. That is because they haven't really shifted their positions. From the Hamas side, they're saying the fact that the Israeli government was saying it will go into Rafah, whatever happens, means that its key demand that there should be a permanent ceasefire, even if its stage wasn't likely to happen. And Israel, in return, has said because of that demand, they couldn't accede to the agreement as it stood.
Sebastian Usher, our Arab Affairs editor. And now to Paris. For the first time in 5 years, the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping is on an official visit to Europe. He's in Paris for talks with the French President Emmanuel Macron and the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen. Europe is China's second largest trading partner after the United States. I heard more from our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield.
What they're saying, well, we don't know. I mean, we've seen the remarks before the cameras, but they are always rather bland, talking about the need for cooperation in order to sort out various world problems and so on. But plenty of sort of goodwill on the surface. But beneath that, we know that there are problems. There's enormous tension between Europe and China on the trade front, with Europe accusing China of offloading its extra capacity in cars, electric vehicles and so on, and China retaliating with investigation into French cognac and liquors and so on. And on Ukraine, which is the other big issue, the French would love to use President Xi as a kind of lever on President Putin, but I don't think there's any particular expectation that that'll ever happen.
This is President Xi's first visit to Europe in 5 years. I mean, what concrete do you think could come out of this visit? Or is it all about really bonhomie? On the surface,
it's not just about bonhomie. This is all about power politics, and it's immensely important. I mean, these are strange and difficult times, and President Xi is clearly the leader of an increasingly assertive China, and Europe, for its part, is increasingly worried about the way the world is developing. I don't think anything specific is going to come out of this, though. I mean, I dare say there'll be some trade agreements here and there, but those are kind of traditional and par for the course. I think far more important is, whether over time, subsequently, we see a change in behaviour from the Chinese towards the Europeans. And, I think the Europeans will see this as a success if there are, movements by China to, for example, accept some of the European arguments about Chinese dumping and so on. But, I mean, the bottom line of all this is that China feels itself increasingly powerful and assertive. It believes that Europe is a declining power. The whole sense of the dynamic is one in which the Chinese feel that they are the ones that hold the cards.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Troops on the Ukrainian front line have told the BBC the army must rethink conscription. Some have been fighting without a break since Russia's full-scale invasion more than 2 years ago. Ukraine is expecting the arrival of the multi-billion dollar US aid package, but it also needs to find more people willing to fight. Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse reports from Eastern Donetsk region.
The rich green of this dense woodland gives you an illusion of calm. These guys are living in a series of bunkers next to a Grad multiple rocket launch system. They are eagerly awaiting this American aid, but its arrival won't solve all of Ukraine's problems because the country is trying to mobilise enough men to replace these exhausted soldiers. As helicopters hug the tree line above, their relaxed commander assures us they're Ukrainian. He goes by the call sign Chish.
Of course there are people who need to have a rest. Those who are at the very front line in the direct contact with the enemy, they are tired. But training people is difficult. My people became professionals after fighting for so long. They know each rocket launcher here.
The bunker is dug into a hillside and you can tell it's well lived in. You've got your coffee pot, as you'd expect, and Alexander, who's the radio operator.
I didn't expect we would win over Russia in 2 or 3 months and go back. If we all go home, inexperienced soldiers might be able to hold the line, but many of them will be killed or injured.
The feeling here on the front mirrors the government's mantra of fighting for as long as it takes, but it's not the case for everyone. Sirens tend to sound wherever you are. In this case, it's Kramatorsk, the eastern city with its huge main square.
Nice to meet you, James.
We're here to meet Ilya. He's been a combat medic on the front line for the past 2 years.
I think it would be more effective if a military recruitment office would say, Guy, you will have super hard job, infantry, but, for example, for half a year. And then you'll go to next level training and you'll got more specific tasks to do.
After months of debate, Ukraine's parliament finally passed a new mobilization bill. It includes the widening of the conscription age, but it's what it doesn't have which has drawn criticism, a limit on how long a soldier has to serve. We're in the scenic Obolong district of Kyiv by the Dnipro River, and we're going for a walk with Inna Sovsun, who is an opposition MP, and she abstained on the vote on this mobilisation bill.
We do have people who started serving on day one of the big war. They have already been serving for over 2 years, including my partner, and they're tired, they're exhausted, they are split from their families. There are more people who are not serving than those who are serving. So the numbers are available. Of course, my understanding is shaped by who I am, by the fact that I, you know, spend countless nights worrying about where my partner is, if he is okay, and so on and so forth.
It's an anxiety shared by millions of Ukrainians, while tired soldiers are torn between needing to defend their country and wanting to go home.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. France has reclaimed the world record for the longest baguette. It had stood at 132.62 metres, set in the Italian city of Como 5 years ago. On Sunday, 12 French bakers set to work in Paris just before 3 o'clock in the morning. And 13 hours later, after using a specially built slow-moving oven on wheels, the baguette was complete. Michael Dos Santos was one of the bakers.
We had scares at certain times. We had to keep the baguette under surveillance all the way, which was not easy, whether during the rise in the oven or during the descent. Even the kneading and shaping, everything was very tense.
The thin, crisp stick of bread had to be at least 5 centimetres thick, with no breakages. A Guinness record adjudicator, Joanne Brent, was there to certify the achievement.
The final measurement is taken by the length of the baguette, and with a great huge record to beat of 132.63 meters, I can confirm that this attempt has been successful. I would like to congratulate you on setting this Guinness World Records title for the longest baguette at 140.534 meters.
Bravo! That's
ooh la la. Well, having beaten the previous record by just under 8 metres, the baguette, around 235 times longer than the traditional French stick, was cut up into small pieces and served with chocolate spread. Still to come here on the Global News podcast, Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, speaks for the first time to the BBC and defends his radical austerity plans.
In economics, miracles don't exist. What would have been the alternative? To continue to print money like the previous administration that generates inflation?
Chasing Mountains is the story of five incredible mountaineers competing to become the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest mountain peaks, the so-called 8,000ers.
Pitting themselves against nature on the roof of the world.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In Chad, people are heading to the polls to vote for a new president after 3 years of a military transition under General Mohamed Deby. Security, high youth unemployment, poor infrastructure, an electricity crisis and a struggling economy have been the key campaign issues ahead of the poll. Our correspondent, Paul Nijay, is at a polling station in the capital.
I can tell you that the streets of N'Djamena this morning are heavily militarized. Military personnel are patrolling the streets to also protect, you know, what they say are voters and civilians as well. It's basically, you know, tight atmospheres, heavy security disposition. Everyone getting into the polling station is being searched.
And Mohamed himself is one of the election contenders. Who is he facing off in this vote?
So he's facing 9 other candidates, including his prime minister, Success Masfar, and the former prime minister, Pahimi Padake. There's also the lone candidate, Lidi Biasemda, who are running in the race. However, people say that it is a two-horse race between him and his prime minister, who, you know, they've, since the campaign trail, they've been pulling crowds and, you know, pitching their political and social agenda to the population. People say that only the results will tell who of these men has the capacity to rule the country, even though, like critics have said, everything has been put in place to ensure that the incumbent remains in power.
Do people really think that this election will count, and what are they hoping for afterwards?
We've spoken to a number of people since we've got here, and what we've got is a confluence of hope, but also of skepticism and also despair. You know, on the one side, there are people who feel that these elections will help setting the country towards democracy, while there are those who say that it is just the perpetuation of inertia, that there is no clear change that can come out of this ballot, given that some fierce critics of the president were barred from running in the election. So some people say that the process has not been made fair for everyone.
Paul Nijay speaking to Beverly Ocheng. Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, has denied that ordinary people are paying for his radical austerity measures. In an interview with the BBC, Mr. Milei, who campaigned with a chainsaw to symbolise his desire to slash public spending, insisted that it was false to suggest the public were bearing the brunt of his sharp spending cuts. He also accepted the Falkland Islands were currently in the hands of the UK, which is notable given past leaders have historically claimed they're Argentine. A South America correspondent, Ione Wells, asked what he would say to a pensioner who told the BBC that people like her are paying for his changes.
Well, actually, that is false. The largest adjustment is being paid by the political corporation. The impact on pensions is only 0.4% of GDP.
But I want to know specifically, what would you say to people right now? Would you say sorry? Would you say thank you to the people who are having to pay a lot more than they were previously?
as a result of the adjustment that's happening.
The mass media will deliberately lie, and people will believe those lies they get through the media. You can't make a macroeconomic evaluation based on the situation of an individual. There you are taking one of the parts rather than the whole. Actually, a particular situation may be influenced by the sort of information that the individual also has access to.
But I think, excuse me, President, and with respect, the information people have access to is the prices they're seeing in supermarkets. I mean, for example, do you know how much a liter of milk costs now in Buenos Aires?
Do you know how many goods assets exist within an economy? So you don't do economics based on the price of an individual asset.
But President, I'm sorry, I want to make sure we're speaking in terms that normal people will understand, because our audience, people on the streets here, are not economists. How does somebody who has seen the price of milk double since you came to office, what would you say to them specifically, the people who are struggling and say that they feel like they are paying for the adjustment, even if you believe it is the right one? What would be your message to them right now? How long should they wait specifically, for example, for things to feel better?
In the last month, salaries started to beat inflation. They went up by 14%. Inflation was 11%.
Would the message be, in simple terms, wait a bit longer? And how long, could you just give me a time frame of how long you'd like people to wait who are struggling right now?
The first thing is that in economics, miracles don't exist. What would have been the alternative? To continue to print money like the previous administration that generates inflation and ends up affecting the most vulnerable? That was not the way to go.
You have promised Argentines a roadmap to making the Falklands, known here as Malvinas, Argentine. What specifically does that roadmap look like?
We believe that has to be within the framework of peace. And as a result of a long-term negotiation process, we are not going to relinquish our sovereignty, nor are we going to seek conflict with the United Kingdom.
What makes you think that the UK would agree to that? Because they've been very clear that they do not want to negotiate this.
They might not want to negotiate today. At some later point, they might want to. Many positions have changed over time.
What kind of time frame would you offer Argentines for that?
I think it's a long time to go, and that this may be approached in the same way as in the case of China and Hong Kong.
Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, talking to our South America correspondent, Ione Wells. Surfers in Mexico have been paying tribute to three men whose bodies were found in a well after they went missing during a planned holiday. Two of the men, who were brothers, had travelled from Australia to holiday with their friend from the US, and the group were camping in a remote area. The authorities say they were all shot in the head. Our correspondent Katie Watson told me more.
The three men, Jake and Callum Robinson and an American friend, Jack Carter Road, they all disappeared last weekend. They were on a surfing trip in Baja California. And what we now know from the Baja California State Prosecutor is that three bodies were identified. They believe the men were attacked. They were trying to stop their pickup truck from being stolen. Apparently, the attackers wanted the vehicle for its tyres. And according to the state prosecutor, when they resisted, the tourists were shot and their three bodies were found in a deep well close to the town of Santo Tomas. There were abandoned tents. Their vehicle was also burnt out. There was also a phone that was linked to one of the surfers that was also found nearby. And very concerned, there's also a fourth body was found in the well, not connected to the case, but I think it speaks to the violence that we see in Baja California, in a state that is frequented by lots of tourists. It's seen as a big destination, especially for people from the US coming down south. But the fact that the violence, of course, is never far away in a place like Mexico.
But how rare is this kind of attack on foreigners?
But it's really, it's taken people by surprise. In fact, there was a group of you know, the surfing community came out to say they needed more security. I mean, look, it's Mexico. Baja California is a violent state. There are drugs, gangs. There's a turf war going on. You know, in many states, this is a huge concern. But at the same time, the fact that it's got, you know, great surfing conditions, it's seen as safe in terms of a huge tourist destination. It's what, just around 100 kilometers south of the US-Mexico border. So it's clearly a destination. But the fact that there is, you know, that there is this kind of side by side, the tourism plus violence, is of course a huge concern. And yes, the state prosecutor said that these were people who wanted to rob the tourists, but they haven't ruled out organized violence. And I think it's very hard to rule out in Mexico, and certainly, you know, in Baja California.
And there have been arrests, haven't there?
Three people have been arrested, one woman and her partner and his brother. One of the men is facing a forced disappearance charge. He's also got a history of drug dealing, domestic violence, vehicle theft as well. And the woman was allegedly found with a mobile phone belonging to one of the Australian men. But they're also confident that more than three people were involved in the attack on the tourists.
Katie Watson. California Dreamin', Monday Monday, Dream a Little Dream. With their distinctive four-part vocal harmonies, the Mamas and the Papas had some of the most memorable hits of the mid-1960s. A crucial part of their success was Mama Cass Elliot. In July, it will be the 50th anniversary of her death at the age of 32. Ever since, people have incorrectly claimed that her death was caused by choking on a ham sandwich. But now her daughter, Owen Elliot Kugel, has written a book to try and make sure people know the truth. She's been speaking to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
The truth is that there was a ham sandwich, but she didn't eat it, and she didn't choke on it. All the leaves
are brown, leaves are brown. This is an attempt to right a rock wrong. For 50 years, it's been said and repeat that the death of Mama Cass Elliot from the Mamas and the Papas was linked to a sandwich. Her daughter, Owen Elliot Kugel, has written a memoir called My Mama Cass, which aims to correct this inaccuracy and reclaim her mother's story.
She told everybody that she was going to be the most famous fat girl that ever lived.
Monday Monday was a US number one for the Mamas and the Papas, but by July 1974, Cass Elliot was an established solo artist and had just finished a two-week run at the London Palladium when her death, at the age of 32, made headlines around the world.
Cass died of natural causes. There was no evidence that she'd been taking drugs or that she'd been drinking.
Cass Elliot had been up for 36 hours straight.
She went to Mick Jagger's birthday party and then stayed up all night, and then there was a brunch thrown in her honor, and then there was a tea thrown in her honor the next day, and by the time she got back to her flat, it was 6 o'clock the following day, you know, and she was hungry, and her dancer made her a sandwich from the only thing that was in the flat, ham, and left it on her bedside table, and she never ate. She never even took a bite. While I'm far away from you, my baby. It was one of the things that really bothered me the most, even as a little girl. Pray for me, my baby. The little kids that I was hanging out with, my friends at school, they didn't know who my mom was or any of that stuff. But I would go home to have play dates with some of these kids, and it was kind of frequent that one of their parents would make a comment to me like, you know, hey, did your mom really die choking on a ham sandwich? It was such a horrible story, and I knew that it wasn't true. I knew that she had died of a heart attack, and it just felt so cruel to have a rumor like that perpetuated. And no one's getting
fat except Mama Cass. Even in her own band's songs and during her many appearances on US TV variety shows, Cass Elliot's weight was used as a punchline.
Even though she was grinning and bearing it through all the fat jokes, they hurt.
Nowadays, fat shaming is treated in a completely different way. How different would it have been for your mum if she was starting out in this environment?
Well, I think it would have been completely different. But that's because there was somebody like a Cass Elliot to kind of pave the way for these other young ladies to be accepted for who they are. She was a trailblazer. I really do believe that she helped lay that groundwork for a lot of people.
like to sing this song especially for my little daughter.
I remember her with that last image that I have of her putting me on the plane and putting my seatbelt on and giving me kisses on both cheeks and watching her through the airplane window, waving bye-bye, and that's bye-bye, and she's gone.
Dream a little dream of me.
The voice of Cass Elliot, ending that report by Colin Patterson. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Muzechka. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in these environments. Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.